Well, the first title was The Unity of All That Lives, Unity, Duality, and Multiplicity. And of course, that is the most basic idea in theosophy. The second one was Man as a Separate Focus within that unity, not only man, but all that lives in the sense of the animal and vegetable kingdoms. And the third one would be Man, a Study in Consciousness, an attempt to evaluate exactly what man is. Now, we're working into a lot of new fields in this. Yeah, I've gone lost the place now. We're finding quite a lot of new fields. The march of science, the movement of science today, which is so rapid, is opening up new vistas in our understanding of the unity of all that lives. But for a very beginning, I'd like to go back to the ancient Aryan idea of what the unity of all is. And the unity is immediately seen as a duality. Now, there is, and always has been, the concept that God is God the Absolute, that which is unknowable, and God manifest, that which is knowable through the world outside us, possibly mainly the world of the senses. That isn't a difficult idea. That's contained in even in the whole of Christianity. Well, in the ancient Indian teachings, it was put a little differently. It was put that Maya, M-I-Y-A, which you've all heard, the word probably, Sanskrit word you've all heard, is illusion, the world of illusion. Now, Maya is therefore the world of matter and energy. Now, today, you see, when I said that science is advancing, we have the concept that matter and energy are one and are interchangeable. Later on, I'll show you how that explains quite a lot of phenomena like dematerialization and various other things. That which remains, that which is eternal, which is spiritual reality, was called, in those languages, Ishvara. Now, Ishvara, in the manifested world, is shown or seen as foci of the one life, points of life. And we, as individual beings, human beings, are self-conscious foci of that one life, whereas the animals are a more diffuse focus, sometimes called the group soul. So, we have the world of Maya and the world of Ishvara, being both the absolute, which is unknowable, and that which is knowable, as points of the one life. Now, between those two is always an interplay. Whenever you have unity, you have a duality. The only thing that can be completely unified is that which, from our terms, is not manifest and therefore is unknowable. But once a thing becomes knowable, it has an inherent duality. And once it has an inherent duality, it has a reaction between the two aspects of that duality, like light and shade, light and dark. There is a relationship between them which makes night and day, and a point at which night slips into day. Or in the planes of a solid object, when you look at it, you'll find that one side is darker than the other, and the relationship between them is a straight line. And we tend to draw a solid object by means of the straight lines, whereas the straight line doesn't exist. All that exists is one plane lit with more light than another plane. And the intersection of those gives you the third aspect. And of course, I'm going to show you in a moment, the third aspect is split again into a primary seven, and then that seven can be split up indefinitely by mathematical means, giving multiplicity. Now, Ishvara is a unity. That is, the real aspect of God, not God in manifestation, but God as the reality or the eternal, is a unity. He cannot appear as the separate and diverse manifestations of a creation except under a false and unreal veil. And the cosmic illusion is Maya. If he is to exist in manifestation, he has to exist as an illusion under an unreal veil. Now, looking at it from a different point of view, we find that all is God. There is nothing in the world that is not God. As a principle, as the life-giving force, the creative force, the sustaining force, the sustaining power of love, however you like to look at it, will, wisdom, and love, will, wisdom, and creative intelligence, which is a better way of looking at the Trinity, they are, that is, all that there is in the world. All life is God. The whole world is his body, physical body, astral and mental body, and so on. Therefore, there is a basic unity of all that lives, not only in the life, but in the form, because the whole of matter is his body, is his force, matter, energy, nothing else. And then, of course, the life, that are foci of his life, of his one life, are linked more directly and more completely with God Ishvara. Therefore, it follows that everything that happens in the world has an effect upon everything else, because everything is one. And that's a primary law, a principle. And that applies not only to the world of action, but the world of thought and feeling. Therefore, you see, when the different aspects or the different separative selves of his in the world of illusion, when they work together for the good of the whole, in cooperation, then we get harmony and the divine life is expressed. When they work one against the other, we get disharmony and the divine life cannot be expressed. It's just really as simple as that. Now, the key to the whole of this is the expression of the divine harmony of the one in multiplicity, which is, to our way of thinking, best appreciated as impersonal love. Now, impersonal love is brotherhood. I'm going to read you just a little bit that was written some time ago. This was written in connection with the film Cry the Beloved Country, but it applies to this particular aspect of our subject tonight. By extending to all life the best understanding and love experienced in our noblest moments with those whom we love most spiritually, we get a concept of the highest impersonal love. By extending to all life, that is, extending not only to the object or person that has brought forth the love in this particular instance, but extending that to the whole of life, the highest understanding and the highest aspect of love experienced in our noblest moments in waking consciousness with those we love spiritually. That is the ideal of the extension of impersonal love of the highest quality, not only to those immediately around us, but to the whole of the world. And that is the counsel of perfection, and that is what a master of the wisdom would do all the time, because he could not do anything else, because he is beyond the bonds of separativeness and the bonds where a lack of harmony exists. It's easier, perhaps, to tempt do this if we realize our unity with all men and all animals and all plants. Now then, of course, it helps also if we remember that man is a soul or spirit, and spirit is the better word for spiritual or higher self, and he has a personality of thoughts and feelings and the body. And unity belongs to the world of the spirit, and therefore thinking of ourselves as higher aspects automatically puts us closer in touch with the aspect of unity which is near the reality of the unity of God. The spirit is on its highest. The spirit at its highest level is one with God. When we come to the second talk, we will go into the technical questions of the existence of the monad, what the monad is, and the relationship of the ego or higher self to the monad. By contemplation, this unity of all beings has been understood and experienced by the mystics, yogis, and seers throughout all ages. This unity is expressed in all the great religions, in Christianity, the Bible, but to us there is but one God, the Father, of whom are all things, and we in him. He is not far from every one of us, for in him we live and move and have our being. And that's the simple Christian statement of the fact. In him we live and move and have our being. And you could add to it that we are him. It's all right, and it's only a half-truth to say that we are gods in the becoming. Because if we're gods in the becoming, we are gods. And in fact, we are gods right from the word go. But it's just a development from latency to potency. And I think we should state it correctly and say we are gods. And at our highest level, we are one with him. All men have this in common, and as they unfold their divine heritage in everyday life, so the great ideal of brotherhood is realized. Now then, getting on now, I think, to the scientific aspect of the whole subject, the unity of all that lives. Perhaps I better go back to this. This is the theosophical concept. The unity is hidden in duality. The unity exists in the duality of spirit-matter, which are one because they are both God and just different aspects of God. Or another way of looking at it is life and form. And it's because of this duality and the relation between the two aspects of the duality that growth is possible. Growth is not possible when complete unity exists. Now that is a startling thing, but it's true. When you're in complete compatibility or harmony with your surroundings and the people around you, you are, in a spiritual sense, stagnating. We know that growth, character building, spiritual growth, takes place when the stress and strain is greatest. That's a principle, and that is true. It is the interaction of life, the spirit, on matter that creates the drama of life as we know it. And God is the matter as well as the life, or spirit, and therefore, in a sense, we are playing the drama of life for God. And that, again, is quite a simple concept when you think into it. In him we live and move and have our being, therefore all that we do is for him and by him and is him. God is the sustaining force. This is literally true. Withdraw his sustaining will, wisdom and love, and his creative intelligence, if you want the third aspect, and the solar system disintegrates. Now, that's literally true. Were we in this world to make such a mess of the opportunities we've been given, then it would be said that we perhaps could blow ourselves up. But what would actually happen is that the stage is reached where the life, the sustaining life, would be withdrawn and the whole would be disintegrated. The method doesn't really matter. That's what would happen. Now, man is miniature of God. Man is the microcosm of the macrocosm, which is God. And exactly the same thing applies there. The whole organized life of man disintegrates as soon as the life of the higher self is withdrawn. It's withdrawn, first of all, at death from the physical body, and then soon after from the etheric, and then to the astral and mental. And when it is withdrawn at each of those levels, then disintegration takes place. So you see that the little unit, man, is exactly the same in that sense, and in many other senses, as the greater unit, the God. And the units beyond God, we're talking of a God of a solar system. For purposes of this study, it's much easier to think of it that way, with the sun as the physical center of that God. But there are galaxies, and the universes and galaxies, and dozens of other suns beyond that again. Now, in the secret doctrine, this sustaining force was called digging holes in space. Now, the thing that comes before that, perhaps we should consider, is the mapping out of the portion of space that is to become his solar system. And that's an enclosure, a ring pass knot, by a circle. It's symbolized by a circle, but in actuality it probably is a sphere or an ellipsoid or some peculiar shape, we don't know. But certainly that takes place. Now that is done by the divine mind at its highest point, at its highest level, before manifestation takes place. And what we call mind, divine mind, the world mind, and the mind of man, is that aspect of manifestation which holds the patterns or the archetypes of the whole, both imperfect and perfect. Now, it is by means of the mind that the whole thing is held together, that the will is expressed. The mind creates the focus. And when you come to consider it a bit further, this changeover from matter to from mass to energy is controlled by the mind. Now this is something new that is just coming out more from Einstein's theories than anybody else's. And you know that that is right from the point of view of what Madame Blavatsky and others have said about materialization and dematerialization. Materialization is evidently, a dematerialization we'll take first, is evidently a transference of matter into a state of energy and back again into, when you materialize it again, into mass or matter. Now, during that process of transferring it from matter to energy and back to matter, the pattern or the form must be held intact by a mind. In this case, it is the mind of the manipulator or the magician. Madame Blavatsky could do that. And she said, to materialize correctly, you must have a perfect and complete image in your mind of what you are going to materialize. Now, this is very interesting because it's tying up with what we've always been told. So, I think now, I better stick to my notes. Now, in the yes, I start to talk about this. Perhaps we better go on with it. When we go or consider the creation of the solar system, we have it's symbolized by an empty circle filled with incomprehensible activity. Actually, God the unknowable is best thought of as activity, incomprehensible because it is beyond our knowing. Sometimes it's thought of as night or darkness, but not a negation. A negation of knowledge, but not a negation of activity. Darkness was upon the face of the deep in Genesis. Darkness alone filled the boundless all, the secret doctrine. The objective world was not mind. The focus of the objective world was not. The Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters upon night, and it was said, "Let there be light," and the darkness is held back by night, and holes are dug in space by the power of God, manifestation of the power of God, which is Fohat, the universal force. So space is held back, and we get the beginnings of the formation of atomic matter, usually in the form of a spiral, because that is the basic form, as you know, of the physical atom, the ultimate physical atom. Now, I've got God the unknowable becomes universal mind and therefore knowable. This universal mind controls and directs the energies that form and sustain the universe, and we can appreciate this universal mind best by a study of universal energies. Now, energy is identified with the one life at the highest levels. Energy, in this case, is aspects of Fohat. This energy is electricity, magnetism, gravity, light, sound, heat, and all wave motion, including matter, atoms, and molecules. The secret doctrine says energy is a reflection of the highest matter. Now, I have a diagram of that. Perhaps when we change the tape, I'll bring it in. Energy is the one universal factor in the physical world. From it are derived the atoms, and by it atoms remain in a state of perpetual motion. It was an intuitional realization that we are now contacting directly this universal divine energy, which caused the sense of awe with which the world greeted the use of the power within the atom. It is this universal energy which is controlled and sustained by the universal mind, and which is the basis of the concept of the unity of all life, the sustaining force of the solar system. And modern science is fast approaching this point of view. Because Sir James Jeans said in his book, "The universe shows evidence of a designing or controlling power that has something in common with our own minds." And if there's any, well, there is a glimpse of hope in the world today, and strange to say, it's coming from that which is the greatest danger. In the hands of science and scientific people, there lies the power to obliterate the whole of civilization. But there is also a dawning understanding that behind all manifestation, as seen to the scientist's eyes, there is a pattern, and there is a creative intelligence, a unity, and that unity is leading the scientists to an understanding of internationalism and brotherhood in its widest sense. And that's why some of the scientists gave the It was because of that conviction that some of the scientists gave the secrets of atomic fission to the Russians, remember? What was the man's name? Nunn, wasn't it? And there were several of them who were imprisoned for it. But they evidently made that pact among themselves. And Jeans and many others, Einstein as well, have got a glimpse of that. Because, you see, if we're to get out of the world troubles that we're in, we have to add spirituality to the rapid advance of material science. But strange to say, there are two ways in which that's being done in the world, as far as I can see anyway. And one is by the spreading of the Eastern philosophy, which is yoga and which is theosophy, and which is the Eastern philosophies of the old writings. And that is being done. Men like Aldous Huxley have written books called The Perennial Philosophy, which is just a statement for the Western world of the Eastern philosophy. And so it's the march of the Eastern philosophy into the Western world that is one of the things that will probably save us. And it is also the understanding of the basic realities of the unity of all life by scientists. I think those are the two bright spots in the world today. Of the reaction between those two appears to be exist, or really energy itself and matter exist through wave motion or vibration. Now, I had pointed out to me in a book that I was reading, one of the flying saucer books, where you get some quite interesting little bits, that is depicted by the sine curve. Now, those of you who have done mathematics will understand the sine curve. It's the, as you go from naught to 360 degrees, through the plus and minuses, the curve of the sine of an angle, that's a trigonometrical term, is that. It's a simple one like that. Now, the Korean flag has that as a diagram. I'm not sure which Korea it is. My kids saved these flags, and I saw it one day. And to me, it's a symbol that was mentioned in this flying saucer book. I haven't heard of it in theosophy at all, but it's simply a circle, which, as I said, symbolizes the enclosure of space, or eternity, or the eternity of solar manifestation anyway, which is the serpent biting its own tail of our theosophical symbol. Well, then if you take a line across there as the center, you go up like that and down like that. And this is colored one way, and that's colored another. That's a Korean flag. And it's a basic symbol, because you see, this is the sine curve, which is vibrations within the ring pass knot of the solar system. That represents vibration. And later on I'll show you how it's linked with what are called the gunas. And that again is an old term, but that, I think that's fascinating. And in this flying saucer book it said that they found this symbol in the flying saucer. Well, that is as it may be. We're not going into that today. But in the world of vibration, matter energy is vibration or wave motion, and there is nothing else. Now, all these are the same thing. Admittedly, that sound down to here requires a material medium for us to hear it, but it doesn't necessarily require a material medium for it to exist. If you ring a bell in a vacuum, you can't hear the bell ringing because you've got no air to transfer it. But it is evidently the same thing. Now, creative sound is that by which the universe is manifested. I suppose I'm too far away from the mic, am I?
Right.
That in which the universe is manifested. The creative word, logos, means word, and there evidently is an octave of sound right at the top, which is creative sound. And sound, therefore, is one of the major soundings of the note. It somehow has to do with the pattern of a particular form, just as we individually have a note, which is ours, and which is a sound. And that the word om, for instance, is the creative sound of the fifth root race, and is very mantric in its effect for that reason, because it is at this level the basis of that manifestation. Then we get into sound that you can hear. Then we get into electricity, radio, heat, light. Then ultraviolet, X-rays, alpha and gamma rays. And then we get down here to those emitted by atomic nuclei, which is nuclear fission, which is the ordinary atomic bomb. Now, it's probable, I'm not quite sure, but I think that the hydrogen bomb is at the other end of the scale, is up here, because that's nuclear fusion, which is a different thing from nuclear fission. Nuclear fission is a splitting up. Nuclear fusion, the hydrogen bomb, is a synthesis. Now, that's a little bit of guesswork there, but it's very interesting to find that at the end of one scale we have nuclear fission, and possibly up here we have nuclear fusion. So you see, we are now getting to the end, and we're working with the top and the bottom of the scale, which of course are where you slide here into the higher worlds and possibly here into the other world. I wouldn't like to say where you slide, but always in life you go from a set of vibrations into another set of vibrations at a different level. It must be a complete circle, and this is just a portion of it. There are gaps here. You'll see that you go from... No, there's no gaps there. Where did the gaps occur? 35 to 40. Well, those vibrations obviously exist, but we haven't got names for them, and we possibly haven't contacted them. Whether in the very latest charts they would be given, I'm not quite sure. But I know that, for instance, radio has now gone, possibly gone back to the 35 by using low frequency. I'm not sure about that, but at that time those vibrations hadn't been filled in.
Yeah. 15 to 20,
yes, between sound and electricity. Well, I'm not in a position to tell you exactly why or how they haven't been filled in.
Cosmic ray would probably come in somewhere.
Cosmic ray does come in, yes. Now, exactly where, again, I don't know. It's normally thought that cosmic rays would be down here somewhere. But it may even be that cosmic rays are outside the scope of this particular chart. Because they may come, you see, from, some of them come from outside our solar system. And these rays, generally speaking, are within the solar system. Because some cosmic rays, not necessarily all, come from outside the solar system. And when that happens, we're slipping out of our ring pass knot into a greater ring pass knot. And it's more difficult to assess the whole value. Now, I think that we ought to talk a little bit about what Einstein did, because this is fascinating and quite easy, really. The mass of the great mass of the so-called thinking people would find it necessary to reconsider the validity of their materialistic concepts if they understood the significance of the search being led by Albert Einstein for a generalized field theory. This was written a few years ago, about 5 years ago, before he died. Of all the pursuits of man, it is science that has most scrupulously avoided attaching importance to non-material things. Yet today it is science that is looking for a very non-material entity, the field, the magnetic field or electrical field, as the cause of material things. And this is a new idea, you see. A field like the magnetic field of the Earth or the field of a radio broadcasting station is a very non-material thing, not seen, not heard. It can only be detected by its effect upon some suitably sensitive instrument, such as a compass for the magnetic field of the Earth or a radio receiver for the magnetic field of a broadcasting station. Modern science is attempting to explain all material things in terms of these non-material fields. Any hope of finding a single principle behind all physical phenomena apparently lies not in the properties of the little particles, but in those of a field of force filling all space. There's your field of force. This is the aim of Einstein's new generalized field theory. Whether or not this theory is corroborated by future experiments, the fact that only in this direction does science hope to find any single physical principle should be of profound significance to thinking people. Now, it's obvious that the real knowledge of the universe, which we're getting towards and which is basic in the primary theosophical teachings, is simple.
is ever so much more simple than the world as we know it today. Because all things are just different aspects of the one force. They correspond. The law of correspondence is the thing that we haven't yet worked out. It's set there. There have been charts done. Mr. Hodgson has some. You may have seen them. But there is evidently a correspondence between every different aspect in the whole world. Now, in the secret doctrine, I believe it says there's a correspondence between chemical action and ethical behavior. Right and wrong. Good thoughts and bad thoughts. Now, when I first heard that, that to me was a complete shock. How on earth could that ever be possible? Well, now, in investigations, we're finding that the chemistry of the body is at least completely dependent upon the right or wrong aspects of thought and feeling. And on the 22nd, the Tuesday after the fellowship of this month, Mr. Goody is going to bring along a machine which is capable of measuring the etheric and probably, I wouldn't be definite, possibly or probably the emotional aspects or intensity of man's thought. And by means of using certain things which act as indicators or methods of evaluating the quality of that emotional life, you can get the quality of the emotional response and the power in terms of energy which goes with it. And it's been definitely established, you see, that our emotional life through the glandular and the endocrine and the system and the chakras affects the chemistry of the body. And I'm willing to bet that if you go a bit further, you'll find that the whole of chemical activity is linked with a corresponding level of astral and mental activity, and linked with a special color, a definite color, that's radiesthesia, you see. These sciences are not exact, but they contain within them a certain value, you see. And you get a link with possibly a mathematical formula. The rate of vibration is probably basic to the whole thing. It's just different octaves, and it goes through the whole lot. A certain type of plant, if your herbal remedies are right, must contain that cell structure which corresponds to a certain emotion and to a certain chemical reaction. It's a fascinating thing. We're just on the fringe of that. Now, to get back to Einstein, well, I'd like to quote first, before we do go to that, a lecture by Mr. Perkins, who's the national president, they call it there, of the Theosophical Society in America. A very able man. He's a commercial artist. He's a perfectionist of the highest degree, and I believe he gives one lecture a year, but it's a perfect lecture. And it's in the Theosophist in two numbers. This is February 58. I think it's in March as well. It's called Mankind's Survival, because, you know, it's funny, but the leaders in this society seem to approach the same thing at the same time from a slightly different angle. And you get the same thing from Robert Mater from a different angle. But it's as though we were the society as a whole were dealing with the same thoughts in line often with other people in the world. Or it may even be that it's the result of teaching in the astral or the mental world at night. The individual may have an awakening to his power of creativity as he orients himself to his source in cosmic being. There will be a fresh sense of direction to that future, a new hope for the world. one might observe that we are waiting for the blazing forth of this great idea which has already appeared. Indeed, it was ushered forward 80 years ago with the reappearance of Theosophy itself. The advance of modern science is firmly establishing this idea. Ever since the investigations into the nature of matter that began at the turn of the century, the discoveries leading to the quantum theory and the theory of relativity, man has been confronted with a world-changing idea that life is coming forth from within, or, as stated in the secret doctrine, life emerges from within. Now, in his latest clairvoyant work, Mr. Hodgson used that expression time and time again. He said it was as though the energy were coming up from within that which he was looking at. In the case of the atoms, which Dr. Linus suggests, not the whole atom, but the nucleus of the atom, that probably would be right. He didn't see the electrons, which are he was looking at the sun of the atom, and he didn't see the electrons, which were the planets revolving around the sun. Remember, in his lecture, he said that. Well, this coming up from within is used, it's most interesting to find, quite a lot in these flying saucer books, which are, as it were, they may be a bit off the beam in a lot of respects, but in other words, they're just a little bit ahead of material science. So we have a welling up from another dimension of the forces of the universe. In other words, what comes to us in the physical world probably comes to us down or up, down through the higher planes into the mental, astral, etheric, and then the physical. And there's a continuous movement through those planes, to those different levels. It isn't just in the physical world, it's slipping all the time into and through another dimension. And another dimension is, generally speaking, a same way of expressing another stage of, or another level of materialization, which is a plane in the old theosophical term, because that term will have to go. It's too misleading, because they interpenetrate one another. They exist within one another, and it's because the different levels of the material world exist within one another that you can get the force acting through them and slipping from a different rate of vibration, which is from one plane to another. See, it's just a different concept. This is the great idea of the 20th century. It has not yet received popular recognition because there have been no significant attention given to its philosophical implications. When this philosophical lag is corrected, there will be a universal reorientation in modern thought to the true direction in which lies that source of life. A major breakthrough in such a reorientation occurred with the appearance of Dr. Einstein's equation, E equals mc squared, denoting that matter and energy are interchangeable, and that matter indeed is slowed down or congealed energy. Matter is slowed down or congealed energy. Therefore, you see that they're different poles of the same thing, and the duality doesn't really exist. Further, there is evidence that known forms of energy are themselves stepped down in quantum jumps from forces of higher velocity. Now, those quantum jumps are when they go from one level, such as the astral world, into the etheric world. There appears to be some sort of definition between the two, some sort of not complete slide from one into the other, especially at the level of the basic atomic atom, the physical atomic atom, or the astral ultimate atomic atom, the ultimate atom. That is, the first subplane, the highest subplane of each plane, appears to have, it's got cosmic significance there. It's outside the ring pass knot of the solar system. We'll see that when we go to the creation of the monads of man. And there seems to be something there which could cause a quantum jump. Today it is no longer to be questioned that the physical universe is the end result of forces operating at great velocities. Subtler levels of energy extending inwards into the realm of mind and of higher consciousness. Perhaps these will one day be traced into regions called spiritual, for want of other terminology. That is happening. The implication is that the physical universe is perceived as emerging from a mental universe, a universe of thought, a universe already in existence in what has been referred to as the divine mind. In other words, at the creation of the world, before that ring passed not was put round space, the whole of the universe existed in a creative pattern in the mind of the Creator. And just the same as before our physical body is conceived and born, it exists in what might be called a fluidic pattern at a mental level, and is precipitated downwards through the mental into the astral, into the etheric, and then the physical body is born. The whole of life, therefore, is governed by a mental pattern, not only at the higher mental world, which is the basic pattern, and its reflection in the etheric. There is a reflection of that world mind at the higher mental level in the etheric, which gives us the pattern of plants. But above that again, at the atomic and probably higher, is the world, is the God's, the divine mind. So we have those three. We have the divine mind, we have the world mind, which corresponds to the highest aspect of man's waking intelligence, that is the touch of the higher mental body, which is above the fourth subplane, which is the key to the whole of man's nature, but I should keep that for later on. And then the third one is the etheric, which contains the patterns of all plants. And that we are now altering the etheric, by that etheric pattern, by using such substances as hormone weed killers. I've probably mentioned that before. It's quite an interesting point. We are now just touching the beginning of the control of the reflection of that divine mind in the etheric world. And we are upsetting the balance of nature, and by means of which by hormone weed killer, the plant grows with tremendous vitality for a short space of time, and outgrows the ability to get food from the earth, and withers and dies. That's the principle of the hormone weed killer. It's lied, of course, with cancer, which is probably the same sort of thing, something to do with the pattern. And it is allied also, of course, with this nuclear fission and fusion and the fallout from atomic bombs, which have the effect, a long-range effect undoubtedly, but an effect of altering the chromosomes and genes so that we are faced with unexpected results in the formation of physical bodies. I don't know about minds, it probably extends the astral mental world as well. But it is thought that there will be deformity in the physical body in future generations where too much fallout and radiation is encountered. Because there we're touching and affecting something of that divine mind. But good may come of it, you see, by putting extra radiated material into the world that is radioactive. It has more energy and therefore more quality of affecting the pattern of the physical body for good. And we may get a rapid improvement in physical shapes, not only in the human body, but in the plant and mineral world and the animal world. I don't know, that's just a suggestion. The implication is that the physical universe is perceived as emerging from a mental universe, a universe of thought, a universe already in existence in what has been referred to as the divine mind. Even beyond this mental realm are subtle levels of first causes, where the universe must be conceived as a creation of archetypal energies, vortices of force so subtle and swift that they are recognizable or classifiable only as being of universal love, a universe of love, and beyond that, a universe of will. And further, yet may we perceive, penetrate to conceive that these vortices of universal force ultimately be points of light in absolute homogeneity, each point in the totality being a spark in the one flaming source of light, of life and light, the universe of light, the first cause. Now, creative sound evidently is the method of creation, but that which is created is light. Let there be light, and there was light. And Mr. Gardner, in his book, The Web of the Universe, says that clairvoyantly you can see the digging holes in space, the holding back of primordial matter by means of a web of lines of force, and where the lines of force meet and cross, you get a point of light. Now, each atom is evidently sustained by a point of light such as that, and it's probable that at another level, or another aspect, we get points of light foci, which are the monads, or the points of life. One of the points of matter, and the other the points of life.